From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Film historian Patrick McGilligan returns to the show this week. He's the author of many fine books, including biographies of Orson Welles, Fritz Lang, Alfred Hitchcock, George Cukor, and Mel Brooks. His new book is called Woody Allen, A Travesty of a Mockery of a Sham. Patrick McGilligan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Patrick McGilligan, when you decided to write about Woody Allen, did you encounter any resistance from your publishers?
No, it's the other way around. I did not decide to write about Woody Allen. We were casting around for subjects and having a talk about it, and he wasn't even discussed. He wasn't on the list. He was far from my thoughts. And then my editor, very nice man, at the end of a long conversation in which I didn't like his ideas and he didn't like mine, asked how I would feel about Woody Allen. And I said, well, I would be happy to write a book about Woody Allen. He said, do you like his films? I said, for the most part, and some a great deal. And he said, do you think he molested his adopted daughter, Dylan? And I said, I don't think so, but if I find out otherwise, you'll be the first to know, and I'll certainly look, you know. And he said, good, let's go to work. It's more logical than you think, because that, you know, first of all, that I wouldn't want to do it because it's a lot of work, and I knew it would be a lot of work, and so it wasn't in my mind. But I had written a book about Mel Brooks, and he and Mel Brooks have something in common. They both worked for a while for Sid Caesar on television. So there's a chapter in the Mel Brooks book where Woody Allen and I write about a little bit. And they kind of have a rivalry of the 70s, both being Jewish comedic filmmakers, former stand-up or former comedians, because Mel never was really a stand-up. And so it was logical for my editor to be thinking about it, and I had thought about it in a sense, you know.
It's quite an undertaking because it's not a short book.
No, it's daunting for a lot of reasons. I usually like a hard job. I like the challenge of a hard job, but I should say, you know, to be accurate, I like it when it's over with. You know, the hard part of it and the job is not enjoyable. And I knew, you know, having written a book about Hitchcock, who directed, you know, something like 53 movies, and that's before you get to the TV series and things that he merely produced or was involved in other ways. I couldn't skip a movie, or somebody in the world would, you know, throttle me for skipping their favorite Hitchcock film. And I knew the same thing was true of Woody, that he had done at that point, the point at which I signed the contract, you know, close to 50 films as director. Then he acted in some and wrote others that he didn't direct. And I knew I couldn't skip any, so I knew it would be a very big, long undertaking. That always gives me pause.
Yeah, no, I would think. I mean, I don't know how many pages it is, but it's substantial work.
Yeah, it's easier when, you know, someone like Mel Brooks directed maybe, I'd have to look it up.
10 movies, you know, or 12.
Somewhere between 13 and 17 films, and some of them are rather inconsequential. So, you know, it's easier. Same with Oscar Michaud. You know, a certain number of his films are lost. So I couldn't do much about it, you know, except write about them, you know, in the abstract and their synopses, et cetera. But it relieves you of, you know, some of the work. Whereas in Woody's case, you know, he directed his last film so far, you know, last year, or came out last year. Yeah. So there was a lot to write about, even before you get to the personal life, which was also a lot to write
about. Yeah. Well, I'm just not sure, because Hitchcock, I don't know how many Hitchcock films there are, but I think Woody Allen is one of the most prolific auteur directors of all time, would you say?
He is. I mean, in his own lifetime, he is. But then, you know, on the other hand, I wrote a book about Clint Eastwood, and he's still directing, and for a long time was directing, you know, averaging one movie a year, which is, you know, about what Woody averages. But, you know, Woody's writing, you know, besides directing and starring often. So it's a, there's a, yeah, he's one of the most prolific. But no, when Hitchcock directed Family Plot, you know, as part of the publicity, they had a picture of him adding a film can to a stack of 52 film cans, and the 53rd was Family Plot. So I happen to know it's 53. But there's always, you know, like in the case of Woody, some people count, you know, Play It Again, Sam, though he didn't direct it, or What's New Pussycat, which he wrote, you know, but didn't direct. And so there's, or The Front, which he stars in and didn't write or direct. Yeah. It's pretty much of a Woody Allen film in a lot of ways. So, and when Woody did his 50th movie in Paris, which is the one that was released a year ago, it was advertised as his 50th movie as director. But so, you know, there's always an asterisk. So yeah, it's more than 50. Yeah, it's a lot. He's very prolific. In fact, his prolificacy is part of the rap against him. You know, people will say, oh, I don't think he made any good movies after that blow up with Mia Farrow after 1992, 1993. And I'll say, well, what about Match Point or Midnight in Paris or Blue Jasmine? And people go, oh, well, yeah, he's made a few. It's hard for people to keep up with them all. Yeah. You know, when I agreed and signed a contract to write the book, I had to go back and look and see what I didn't see, you know, much less what I had forgotten I saw, you know, and with that which I had to re-see. But there was, you know, it's hard to keep up with someone so prolific.
And when they make that many films, there's a better chance that there will be bad ones than if they only make a few films.
Yeah, and there was that rap against Woody, you know, that as he got older, they got less funny, which is often true of comic filmmakers or comedians. But I think his average is pretty good. You know, in the book, I do one thing that I'm proud of that took a lot of effort also, which is I poll over 100 U.S. film critics, some of whom I have passed on and are no longer alive, some of whom at the time that I did the poll had been around to review the very first Woody Allen movies, you know, Take the Money and Run, as writer director. Mm-hmm. And some of whom were quite young and had, you know, blogs and were part of a newer generation, but over 100. And, you know, I report the results. I asked a series of questions, including whether or not people thought Woody was guilty of child molestation, whether they believed the allegations against him. But I also asked everybody to name their five. Some people cheated, named 7 or 10, you know, favorite or best Woody Allen movies. And at the end, when I tally up the results and reveal, you know, the 5 to 10 greatest Woody Allen movies ever made, according to the critics, you know, I say it's a lot easier to name the 10 or 15 that weren't cited by anyone. So out of the 50 movies plus, because some people will name Play It Again, Sam, or The Front, or, you know, What's New Pussycat, regardless of whether or not Woody directed it, there are, you know, only about 15 movies that people didn't name. So people named, you know, 35 out of 50 or so as among their favorites or the best that Woody ever did. That's not a bad average. That's a pretty good average.
Pretty great.
And this excludes some films that are really, really very good that have gone by the boards over time, like Interiors, which was nominated for, you know, multiple Oscars and was highly regarded in its day and didn't get a single vote as one of the 5 or 10 greatest Woody Allen films ever.
Yeah.
From 100 plus film critics. So most of the films, you know, you'd have to say were in the post 1992, 1993 category. But that's also partly, I think, because in that category, after that period of time, a lot of people were driven away from seeing his films. So some of the films people hadn't seen.
Right. And there's been, I think there's been quite a few really interesting ones. of his latter-day films. I like Cassandra's Dream. And
I like that quite a bit. Yeah. I agree. It got votes. It got votes. It's kind of shaky and falls apart, or there's parts that are shaky, but it's a very powerful film, very good film. I think the last film was pretty good, Coup de Chance, and the one that had so much trouble getting released because it came at the second wave of the Me Too charges against Woody, Wonder Wheel, is a very, very good film. The rainy, whatever it is, rainy day in New York. That's a very good film too. So he really only has, I mean, even from my, I don't make these kind of judgments in the film. I don't name my five favorite Woody Allen films, but you know, from my own, you know, quiet point of view, he's only has a few stinkers, you know, outright stinkers, and Hitchcock only has a few outright stinkers, and people would get, you know, very angry with you if you said what you thought a stinker was, because people like people like the stinkers, you know.
Yeah, I love Family Plot, you know. Sure.
Yeah, well, that would be a stinker. Yeah, I was on the set of Family Plot, so I'm fond of it for that reason. But that's about the only reason.
Yeah, today, just to talk about Hitchcock for a minute, today a lot of people don't like Frenzy or Eschew Frenzy. And I think Frenzy happened to be one of the most interesting movies he ever made.
It's near brilliant. And parts are really, really great. And I think people don't like it because it's very unpleasant. You know, very, very, Hitchcock finally got to do unpleasant things on screen the way he always wanted to make people, to revolt people over the violence that he was depicting, you know.
Yeah.
And then I think the actors are not great always, or they're great, but they're not as attractive as Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman or Grace Kelly. And, you know, the same thing can be said of Rainy Day in New York or Coup de Chance or Wonder Wheel, you know, that some very unpleasant things happen in a lighthearted fashion, you know, and older critics especially are not particularly in tune with the actors, you know, the actors of Rainy Day in New York especially, which is very, very good film, beautifully put together, but the actors are young people, you know,
right,
that were not, you know, supremely established at the time. Well, now they're established.
Of course, he's famous for that. I mean, all through his whole filmography.
Absolutely famous for that, and deservedly so. And as much as anyone who is a prolific director, he has, you know, it's probably his casting agent as much as him, but he has a great eye for talent. You know, Diane Keaton was not well known at all, and when he cast her on stage first and then in films. But he has done this over and over again throughout his career. He was always doing it partly, it's funny because you don't think of it this way, but he's always partly doing it for economical reasons. You know, someone's less well known or they're on television, so they'll be in a film, won't cost too much, because he's such a budget-conscious director. But he's very, very sharp about spotting people in comedy or on stage or from television or from other films, elevating them and giving them really great parts that we notice them for. Either we notice them for the first time or we notice them differently because they're so
good. I immediately think of Julie Kavner in New York Stories or Mira Sorvino. You know, these are people that we didn't really ever think of or even know.
Mira Sorvino is, Julie Kavner in many, many Woody Allen films. And sometimes she plays his girlfriend, his mother, his wife. You know, she plays all kinds of like different attachments to him. And she's so good and reliable. She can do all those kinds of things. But Mira Sorvino is a great example because even subsequently, you know, she has not shown on the screen in the same way. She's so great in that film, really great. in part because the role is so perfectly written for somebody to waltz in and put it on like a coat that fits perfectly and then do her job. And that's, you know, that's one of the things about Woody in casting, which is funny, is that he doesn't like to be friendly. You know, it's some kind of psychological condition on his part. So actors will come and see him, and he'll see them for, you know, shake their hands, look at them, and maybe not in the eyes, and then shoo them out of the room as quickly as possible so they wonder what they did to offend him. This was always true, you know, dating from his very first films. And then he's looking at them. First of all, he won't even see them or meet them unless he thinks they might be right. And then when he sees them, oh, they're perfect. That's just the character, the way she's going to look just like the character I had in my head, or like that kind of just suits the character kind of thing. So apart from favorite people that he uses over and over again in different ways, and there's many people besides, you know, Julie Kavner, there's also Alan Alda, you know, from the right. beginning of his career, who keeps popping up, or Tony Roberts, or Diane Keaton, you know, for a long time. Mm. Apart from favorite people, he's really, really good at writing. He's a writer first, and then he imagines the character that he's writing in a certain way, and then he goes shopping, you know, for somebody who looks like the character that he imagined. And then he meets them and he goes, oh yeah. And then often he doesn't say much to the actors at all. You know, there's a story in the book of how Angelica, from her autobiography, about how Angelica Houston really wanted to have lunch with him, you know, to get to know him, because she was so happy to be cast, you know, in Crimes and Misdemeanors. And, you know, she phones him up and he's, what's wrong? Oh, nothing. I would just like to have lunch with you, Mr. Allen. Well, I have a cough this week. You know, is it important? No, I just, well, how about, she says, well, mate, could we maybe do it next week? Well, what if I have a cold next week? You know, she never did get to have that lunch with him. You know, she's great in the film. It's a great film. Gets many votes as among the five greatest ever, Crimes and Misdemeanors. And then yeah. she comes back in Manhattan Murder Mystery, and it's a lot of fun too. So he liked her. But he never, it's rare for him to send a little note, like rare. I mean, it might be non-existent for him to send a little note afterwards and say you were good, you know, because he doesn't do that on the set. Mm-hmm. It's not the way a lot of actors and actresses like to work. And they like to have, a lot of actors and actresses like input, yeah. feedback, you know, a kind word.
Well, Doris Day, when she was working on The Man Who Knew Too Much, right? She went to Hitchcock and started crying and said, if you're not happy with me, go ahead and fire me. And he said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, you haven't spoken to me at all. And he said, well, if you weren't doing a good job, I would speak to you.
Yeah, there's a story in the book of Javier Bardem wandering around the set of Vicky Cristina Barcelona, you know, looking for a cup of coffee and then bumping into Woody, who is, you know, doing roughly the same. And Woody looking at him, oh, Javier. Nice to see you this morning. and Javier saying, well, and that's the only thing he said to me, you know, during the entire film. It was as though he was surprised to notice me, you know, on the set. That's the way he is. It's a bit of a mystery. First of all, it's always a mystery when a like taciturn director doesn't say much to a performer and gets a great performance.
Academy Award winning performance. I mean, well,
yeah, it's always a bit of a mystery, and it's always true in the case of certain great directors who know exactly what they want and they get it largely by the script and by casting. And after that, they give room, you know, for the performance. And, you know, there's a story in the book of a actor who's in Take the Money and Run, Bananas, and he's one of Puerto Rico's, you know, later becomes one of Puerto Rico's most distinguished actors, and he's standing up, he's sitting down doing a scene, and he says to Woody, can I stand up, you know, for this scene, I think it'll work better, and Woody goes, okay, you know, because that's sort of what he says, and then Woody says, well, you know, and he always says this to actors that really throws it, he says, you know, just take the script and you know improvise anyway, you know, add, subtract, do things, what, you know, and the Puerto Rican actor just spent all of his time, you know, phonetically learning the script in English, and he's being told to improvise. So he gets up and he improvises and improvises, and he's doing it. He's really good. He thinks he's doing the best he can. And we say, wait, wait, let's go back to the script. So he does encourage improvisation or people departing from a script. It really boggles the minds of actors who regard him as one of the greatest screenwriters of all time, which he is. And but he doesn't regard it as sacrosanct. But if they're off in the wrong direction, they'll hear about it, you know.
Well, you've written about people who are no longer around, and you've written a couple of books about people who are still active and working. Is there a difference for you when you're writing a book about Fritz Lang and writing a book about Orson Welles to writing about Mel Brooks?
There's a big difference even in the generation, because people who are, you know, done and gone, you can first of all find people, especially in the old days when there were a lot of people around who hadn't been interviewed to death, you could find people willing to talk about them, you know, intelligently and not mincing words out of fear or caution or something. Nowadays, everybody is keenly aware of social media and DVD extras, and it's very hard to find someone who's never been interviewed before on the subject of somebody very important that they worked with. There's that. And then there's, if people are alive, it's very difficult to end the book.
Right.
So I wrote a book. My first book in that regard was about Robert Altman. I'm very proud of the book, and I interviewed many people because, again, this was before social media and DVD extras and everybody being keenly aware of their effects of their words on legacies and publicity, et cetera. And the book ends in 1989 because that's around when the book was published, and Altman's career looked kind of over.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
And so, you know, I created a scene where he gets up in the morning and looks in the mirror and starts to shave and thinks about his future. And it's an invented scene, you know, because that didn't happen. And then he went on to have a magnificent Act Three, which I've never written about because my book ended before Act Three. So it's hard when they're still alive. And it's nice when they're still alive, because the truth is, it's a sad thing about film history and also about biography, and let's say it's all the more so nowadays in the age of non-literacy and illiteracy, that people who are still alive have more currency with the readers. So they know who Clint Eastwood is, even if you show them a picture of Clint Eastwood in the 1970s students, because I teach film classes, you show some young person a film, show them Dirty Harry, you know, and they can't believe that's that guy Clint Eastwood, who they saw in that other movie, you know, where he's a grizzled old guy, his face is granite. So there are all kinds of things you cope with, and it was true in Woody's case, where, you know, I had to, because the book kept getting delayed, and so I kept having to rewrite the tentative ending, you know, and then you worry about things that you write that are no longer going to be true after they're published, you know, and that's not true when someone is long deceased or when they're from the golden age, and you can sum them up differently.
Well, to the degree that people watch Charlie Chaplin and enjoy his films today, you never hear people say, well, he's a pedophile, so I'm not going to watch his films, even though, in Chaplin's case, you know, clearly he was, I mean, I don't know what a definition of a pedophile is exactly, but he did have a lot of girlfriends who were, you know, under the age of legal consent and married a couple of them. But you don't hear people talk about that. But anytime you mention Woody Allen, I mean, that is something that people think about and talk about. And it kind of brings up a larger issue of how do you appreciate the work of artists whose lives that you may not admire. You know, Juliette Lewis' character in Husbands and Wives said, you know, Triumph of the Will is a great movie, even though I hate the subject.
Yeah, I don't I find it difficult when somebody is, you know, Leni Riefenstahl, to like the movie at all. Look, I write in my afterword to the book that I've written books. I wrote a book about Fritz Lang. Some people think he murdered his first wife. Wrote a book about Clint Eastwood. There's a point in Clint Eastwood's life and career, which I write about in the book, where he had a public marriage and child, and he'd go home after Rawhide to another wife and child and push the baby stroller around the block. So by any definition, that's bigamy, you know? And especially Hollywood, and to some extent, and I'm thinking more broadly, show business, you run into people that I honestly mean this kindly, they may not be very different from everybody in my neighborhood, meaning they might just be ordinary human beings with flaws. I do take a moral ground sometimes. I do with blacklisting, for example. I don't take a puritanical higher moral ground. I would say in the case of Chaplin, you know, it is important to say how old were the women and what exactly happened, and how did it eventuate. All of these things, if you generalize, then yes, you have to be against any kind of sex abuse of any gender by the other gender or by the same gender. But if you particularize, then you have to say, well, what exactly happened? How bad was it? What charges were filed? Who was convicted, et cetera? In Chaplin's case, I'm not sure, Gary, I would have to reread the books to find out how old the women were in each instance. And he did go to trial, and he was convicted. And most people believe he was wrongly convicted, that he was convicted of something that was untrue, in other words. And then he was eventually, you know, thrown out of America, and his work was blacklisted, and he couldn't work as a director for a decade. And the last young woman he married, and she was young, I don't know whether she was 17 or 18, he stayed married to, and they had a lot of children, and they had a long, happy marriage. So you have to think about these things, not as if you're in church, you know.
Right.
You can think about them to an extent as if you're in a courtroom of law, but even there, I say the questions in Chaplin's case are complicated by a lot of factors, and he's compared in the Woody Allen book. They're compared. Their situations are compared. And again, in Woody's case, I did my best throughout the book to be very particular and to particularize what he did, when he did it, what we know he did for sure versus what other people say he did. And even in the case of the women, you know, all the way, and then to a certain extent, the women on screen, because Manhattan is the, you know, the worst example of Woody, you know, womanizing somebody underage on screen. It's, you used the word of legal age. It's, I don't find a clear example where the woman wasn't of legal age. And you will have to look up that definition in my book and in law to know that there is a, you know, statutory age where people are allowed to socialize and have sex, you know, with the other sex or with the same sex. It doesn't matter. And that's the age of agreement between the sexes, you know, and it, in many states, it's 17. I'd have to comb through my book to be certain of this, but I don't find any clear example of Woody preying upon someone under age 17, except, let's put it this way, perhaps when he's 16, he preyed on somebody who was under 16, but he was a virgin and stayed a virgin until he was a young man. So I'm not joking about it. I would just say, if you look at it in a very particular way, saying how old were the women? Yes, there was a period of time in his a life, and then all the way through to his marriage to Sun Yi, when he was interested in young women. Now, unfortunately, for people who are very puritanical or for people who are extremely feminist on this subject, there is a statutory age. That means a legal age when a woman can do whatever she wants and a man can do whatever he wants, as long as they're both of that age. Now, would I be a deeply offended if Woody took up with my daughter, as Bill was deeply offended and permanently angry, driven to craziness? Would I be? Yes. And if I was the father of that girl or young woman, would I be deeply upset even if she was 17 years old and of legal age? Yes. And I say it's one of the, I don't like Manhattan very much, even though the critics that I polled do. I never liked it very much because I think it's a flawed movie by that logic, which comes from Woody's life, which is that he's dating a high school girl, even though he's like, or I say girl, but she's a young woman. And she's theoretically 17 years old, you know, and it's apparently okay to everybody else in the film, including all of his friends. And her parents, who never raise an objection that is told to the audience. So, yeah, I find that to be a rather worrisome construct, you know, for a story. And I find it objectionable. Is it against the law? No.
Well, we are talking with Patrick McGilligan, and he is the author of a new book called Woody Allen, A Travesty of a Mockery of a Sham. 1979, the year, I think it's the year of Manhattan, 79?
I think it is, yeah.
In 1979, it was kind of a different time than times now. It was definitely different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was and different. People did different things.
Especially in New York.
And, yeah. And in your book, you even mentioned that Mariel Hemingway's parents had absolutely no objection to anything that might have happened between Mariel Hemingway and Woody if he was going to take her to Paris or whatever.
No. The real-life parents of the young women that he was associated with during that period of time, and all the way up through Sunyi, because Mia was looking the other way, thinking about something else entirely, too. The parents were either, you know, ignoramuses or willfully ignorant or accepting of the situation.
Right. So, I mean, it was just kind of a, you know, we're looking at, sometimes we look at these things through our lens of 2025, in the same way that, you know, if we looked at Charlie Chaplin and Lita Gray, she was maybe 15, I think, when they married. But people didn't live as long in those days as they live today. Life was a shorter thing, and people grew up faster. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't alive in 1925, so
I don't know. Well, if Lita Gray was 15, and I don't doubt you because you probably did your homework for this interview, well, that's not statutory age, you know, and therefore it's illegal and he could be charged. And eventually he was charged for that kind of behavior. Was it more acceptable then? I don't know. Is it acceptable at all? I don't think so. You know, and I mean, I'm not saying it should be acceptable, but I'm saying when it's if you particularize in the case of Woody, you don't find clear examples that are factual under age 17. You just don't, you know. And Sun Yi was much older in 20 going on 21 when he took up with her, you know, or 19 going on 20. Again, that's, you know, college age when a lot of college men and women fool around sexually, you know, with abandon, you know, yeah. As well they should, you know. So, yes, you should. You have to look at it, and then you might say, okay, Charlie Chaplin, he learned his lesson, he reformed, and he became a good family man. And then you might accept that, you know, or you might say, well, whatever else Woody did, he finally had a really good marriage with two children and seems to be a strong, positive family. And he's a good father and husband. And you'd have to say that. Anything to the contrary is kind of silly, you know, for you to say at this point. So you have to sort of particularize it. And therefore, you might not like works of Woody's in particular that seem to uphold this stupidity of like older men can chase women who are still in high school, you know. And that's a to me is a perfectly reasonable critical position, you know, but it's not a legal position, and it's really, you know, a critic operating from their own, you know, moral viewpoint, which we all do anyway. I try to be careful. I try to particularize about it in Woody's case. I try to look very specifically at what he did and why he did it and what he says about it, which is usually not pretty hapless, usually what he says in his defense. But what the other people say too, you know, what the women say too.
Right. Well, you know, that's an interesting thing about this, the Me Too movement. When people accused Harvey Weinstein or Kevin Spacey, there was a piling on of other people who said, yeah, me too, right? Yeah. But with Woody Allen, there has been, I mean, I would say clearly he showed poor judgment in choosing Sun Yi because, you know, there are a lot of women in the world who are not the adopted daughter of his previous girlfriend. But like you say, they've been together for 25 years, just like Chaplin and Una O'Neill.
Yeah. So, you know, in the end, you have to say, yeah, he chose really poorly. Or did he choose well? You know, I mean, for himself, meaning he got out of it something extremely positive. He also wrecked his career and his reputation and his image, and also wrecked that family, you know, including his permanently estranging himself from his, you know, son, Ronan. Then called Satchel and other names. So it's a mixed, you know, unfortunately, our heroes are not perfect and our villains are not perfect either. You know, they're human beings, and you have to sort of take the wheat with the chaff or sort of separate them out. And your question originally was, should we think of their work separately from themselves? But I'm a biographer, so I like it when people think of people's life stories as in some ways inseparable from their work. And Woody as an auteur, both as a writer, certainly as an actor, because his persona is a meld of the real Woody and the fictional Woody that originally we saw on stage, you know, as a stand-up. And then his directing, where he's shaping exactly what we see in the story that he's telling us. This is Woody, both real and fictional, you know, amalgamated. So I think it makes sense for people to sit around going, well, how much of Woody's womanizing in films is the real Woody, you know, and to get upset about it. I don't get upset about womanizing.
Yeah.
You know, I can see why some women would, yes. You know, but Woody is a fairly successful womanizer with fairly pretty intelligent conquests. You know, I mean, whenever anybody's taking up Mia Farrow's case very strongly, let's say vehemently, or let's say from one side, they neglect to mention her work with Woody. They rarely, you know, celebrate her work with Woody. This is very important. She's a great actress in several Woody Allen films, and which would be unthinkable without her, which he was doing with her as part of their relationship. And so he was extracting the Mia Farrow he knew off camera, as well as imagining and extravagantly reinventing her on camera in a way that she had never been before and has never been since.
That's right.
And, you know, some of those things like Broadway Dani Rose, she's astounding. She should have gotten an Oscar. She's astounding. The film is unthinkable without her. She completely takes her persona of sweet, nice, weird, you know, Mia, sometimes weird. And then she completely like explodes it into this brassy, you know, gum chewing, you know, cigarette smoking brassy dame. She does the same in Radio Days. She's fantastic in Purple Rose. She helps make Hannah and her sisters in Crimes and Misdemeanors as great as they are. So, Yeah, I think I don't shrink at people saying the real person is also the fictional Woody. They are. They're an amalgamation. They're a blend. The challenge for me, the trick, the difficult thing is to separate them out and say which is which. And you can't. You can't always because both are the same. After all this time, you know, the persona and the image of Woody is Woody, while at the same time, this other really peculiar, off-putting, socially clumsy guy who's off-screen, not very funny, is also Woody, you know, who's grim and bleak and fatalistic. That's also Woody. So they're both. And that's the greatness of the three roles that he plays in the book, which is different than Clint Eastwood, for example, who doesn't write scripts. So you're always looking at how Clint sees himself in the script that he's directing. And that is, therefore, you get more of a, to me, a more of a monochromatic Clint, you know, this persona, I alone can fix it, you know, that persona. Whereas with Woody, you're looking at a guy who's writing himself into the story, using parts of his real life and fictionalizing and imagining other parts. He's always more of a surrealist than a realist, you know. And then a guy who gives a performance, which is not Woody at all, but it is Woody, you know. And then he's directing everybody else to create a worldview and an idea of himself and his values at the same time. So it's complicated, and I can see why people get confused, you know, and think that the guy in Manhattan is Woody, because he is, you know.
Yeah.
But he's also not Woody, and he's not Woody, the womanizer of young girls, exactly the way some people think. You know, it's a little bit more peculiar than that, because Manhattan's extremely romantic, you know, romanticized version of that relationship. So it's a little bit more peculiar than that. And as far as I can tell, some of the young girls were like the character that Mariel Hemingway played, but they all think they're Mariel Hemingway, or the two or three that might be, and they all influence that character, and none of them are her exactly, because she's a fictional character based on Woody's life experiences.
Well, in terms, just to touch on this again, the relationship on screen between the Woody Allen character and the Mariel Hemingway character is not that much different than Fred Astaire and Leslie Caron, or Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn, right? I mean,
no.
Gary Cooper.
No, it's not. It's not. And I write about that for one paragraph in the book, explaining that some of the great romantic pairings in screen history were separated by 30 years, yeah, you know, in age. It's a Hollywood conceit, you know, of long standing. It's probably a theatrical conceit dating back centuries. It's a lot of it is Pygmalion and My Fair Lady, two properties that Woody adored as a young man and as a out of high school, and that he in various ways puts back into his movies over and over again. Born Yesterday is another example, this sort of gum chewing young broad, you know, who like is the mistress of an older, corrupt, you know, sleazy congressman, and then is rescued by a white knight who comes into her presence, who would be the Woody Allen character.
Who educates her. The education is the key, right, in Born Yesterday. She becomes
education. And raising, seeing someone's, you know, seeing the flower, you know, beneath the soiled image of the prostitute that Mira Sorvino plays,
yeah, you know, seeing the
porn star prostitute that Mira Sorvino plays, seeing the budding intelligence and charm beneath the surface. This is a big thing in Woody's work, but it's a big thing in stage and screen dating back, you know, all time. So I don't shrink from it. I it's obviously has been a very successful conceit in show business for a long time. Good, yeah. And obviously it's a male conceit, you know,
because they're the ones making the movies.
Or maybe that's not obvious, but it's, you know, it's the playwrights, the great playwrights and the great progenitors, you know, Garson Kanin in the case of Born Yesterday, they would plead guilty to being male, you know, and will the female inverse or reverse of that be equally good or better? Yes. Well, it will be. It will be. But Woody can't pretend to be a female or a feminist.
Rhett Butler is 20 years older than Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind.
Absolutely. Film after film. Well, you know, and it's really sometimes it's the characters, but sometimes it's the actors are 30 years older than each other, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a time-honored conceit. Is it? Does that mean it's really a brilliant, wonderful conceit? No, but it kind of, I mean, no, but My Fair Lady and Pygmalion and Born Yesterday, they're not shitty little
those are good
vehicles.
Pictures.
You know, they're pretty good vehicles. So if you say to me, well, it should be a older woman and a younger man, I would say, yeah, it worked well in The Graduate, and it's also written by men, but it can work. It should work in reverse, and the feminist version is going to be great. And there should be just going to be, you know, classic and famous feminist versions, I'm sure, because it's not. This conceit comes out of human behavior and the fact that boys in high school fall in love with the mother of their best friend. You know, that's what it is. And can that be reversed so that it's better or equally good? Course, and it should be.
Well, Patrick McGilligan, Eric Lax, who's written about Woody Allen, was here on my show, and he, in his book and talking to me, seemed to think that it was absolutely impossible that Woody Allen could, in fact, have molested his daughter Dylan in the attic, which is the thing that he's been charged with. But I think in your book, you try to lay out a scenario in which it is possible. Is that right?
No, not exactly right. I think it's very difficult to say nothing is impossible, and it's very easy to say anything is possible, and I don't say either. I just go very carefully and, you know, painstakingly, and I would also say painfully, you know, through all the known facts. And the known facts do not favor a version of reality in which Woody molested Dylan, because there's no factual evidence for either the allegation or the charges. There's only one very young girl's version of what happened, which could be greatly influenced by the duress of her family situation and her own imagination. Or there is Woody telling bald-faced lies over and over again. And all I say is, after going through it all, I think depict, you know, what possibly happened, or why both parties say what they say, let's put it that way. And I feel comfortable with that because now, given this great remove in time, given the fact that no charges were ever made in a court, there was no arrest, no arraignment, no trial, no conviction, I feel pretty comfortable in saying we'll never really know for sure until, you know, unless there's a deathbed confession by either one of the two major parties, and you could say me as the third party, but I mean a deathbed confession from Dylan that she lied or from Woody that he lied, you know. I don't think that's going to happen. So then it becomes, for a case like that, what do you believe? You know, I don't say what I believe. What I do is,
do you want to tell us what you believe?
No, I think it's in the book. I lead the reader in the direction of what I think happened, and why everyone says something happened. And I don't need to state it because it would be just my belief. And I think the worst thing in the world when there are no facts about an alleged crime is for masses of people to go on social media and the internet and say, well, I don't care. This is what I believe. And the person should be blackballed. Or I don't care. This is what I believe. And Dylan Farrow should be shut up.
Right. Right.
I don't believe either of those things, meaning I don't say in the book that I believe Stardust Memories and Deconstructing Harry are two of Woody Allen's greatest films. Why? It wouldn't be a very popular belief is one reason. You know, the second reason is because I don't impose my beliefs on the subject matter.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I respect Eric Lax a great deal, and I respect his belief. Yeah. He has, I would say, greater incentive to believe, you know, because he's Woody's very good friend and he's been Woody's, you know, channel to the outside world for several books. I feel this whole thing of like what I believe and therefore, you know, there's some feminist crusader or Me Too crusader says in the book, I don't care if Woody is guilty or not. I believe he's guilty.
Yeah.
And I'd rather be right. I'd rather, join in saying I believe he's guilty than being found out wrong that he, over a long period of time, that he wasn't guilty or something. It's quoted in the book. In other words, people will believe things regardless. You know, we see this today in the Trump era everywhere. People believe things regardless of facts. And they raise their belief above the facts. So I can sit here and say to you, I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. And I have close friends who would jump down my throat,
yeah,
with their beliefs. Why? Why? I don't want. Why should I give you my belief as fodder? You know. And that's my feeling about whether or not I believe what he's guilty. What I believe is not important. And honestly, what other people believe is not important. And what is factual and truthful, to the best of our knowledge, that is what is important in the case of that question. Now, whether or not Stardust Memories is a great film, that's a different question.
Well, you
that's
go-
a total belief. That's a total belief having nothing to do with facts or truth.
You do call it one of his most misunderstood films.
I do. I like that film. I do like that film quite a bit. But and a lot of people in the poll did too, but not enough to put it in the top 10. I like the messy, chaotic Woody Allen films with some exceptions, you know, because Crimes and Misdemeanors is sublimely controlled, and I like that movie a lot. But anyhow, it's a very messy, you know, anarchic, chaotic, you know, movie. You never know quite where it's going, or, you know, scenes are very messy in terms of their emotional outpouring and what happens in them and how they hook up with what happens next. And I like quite a bit. It was the critics who can't agree about much else, you know, among themselves, all, you know, the vast majority of them ranked Annie Hall as number one. So poor Woody, he's getting, because he'd hate this, you know, or, well, he wouldn't like it. But poor Woody, when he dies, the first line will be, you know, the child abuser who made Annie Hall one of the greatest romantic comedies of all time, because he wouldn't want to be remembered just for Annie Hall, which is a great movie. But there, whether or not you like a movie, that's a belief system. Whether or not somebody is guilty of a crime, that is not a belief system. And it's unfortunate for the many people who are permanently turned off by Woody and his films, you know, because of allegations against him and then the Me Too movement that kind of piled on with their ideas about him. That unfortunately, there is no evidence that led to an arrest, a charge, a conviction, a trial, you know, jail sentence. There's not even a lawsuit. And now we're so far away from that time, you know, when those controversial events erupted, you know, 30 plus years, there's not going to be anything that's conclusive or definitive, barring deathbed confessions, which even those must be considered dubious, you know.
Right. Anyway. Well, there's so much more than that in this wonderful book, Woody Allen, A Travesty of a Mockery of a Sham.
It's good. We had to be careful not to let it overwhelm the book.
It's a great book, and I really enjoyed it. And the author, the brilliant Patrick McGilligan, thank you for chatting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary, anytime, and I appreciate you inviting me back.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.